That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to That's What She Said, conversations with interesting people from the world of sports, music, comedy, and more, talking about their lives, careers, successes, and failures.
I'm Amino Hassan, and this is my dilemma. I have raging eczema, and it dries up my skin, and it becomes very itchy, and I got to lotion 700 times a day, and even then, I still itch a lot, and people think it's just because I'm unclean.
Ah, this is actually a tricky dilemma for the commish, because I am neither a doctor, nor do I play one on TV, so I need to outsource this fix, and I know just the person. Let me just call up my friend, Dr. McGillicuddy. Dr. McGillicuddy, tell me about eczema.
Eczema is a group of conditions that cause inflammation of the skin. Typically, eczema causes skin to become itchy, red, and dry, even cracked and leathery. Things that might trigger eczema include stress, contact with irritating substances such as wool, synthetic fibers, and soap, heat and sweat, cold, dry climates, or dry skin.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. McGillicuddy. So I think it's become clear you can't get stressed. Don't use soap. Don't get too hot, but don't get too cold either. And also don't get too dry. The commish would suggest you get regular exercise. Set aside some time to relax. Maybe find some hobbies that will take away from the stress of your job. Also, get a humidifier. And if it gets too bad and Dr. McGillicuddy is not available, I guess just wear long sleeves and pants, which should be fine in Arizona year-round, right?
The commish has spoken.
Tissot is the official watch of the NBA. Each one of Tissot's timepieces delivers quality performance and traditional luxury. The Tissot Chrono XL is a great watch for those looking for a sporty chronograph with Swiss technology at an unbeatable price. While the Tissot PR100 family of watches bring together sporty and feminine details for a collection that's bold, romantic, and ideal for the modern woman. Shop Tissot at us.tissotshop.com and at select watch and jewelry stores nationwide.
That's what she said.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Happy to have Amin El-Hassan back on the show. NBA analyst and commentator. He can be found on The Jump, Le Batard Show with Stu Gatz, Outside the Lines, SportsCenter, occasionally writing for the site, and formerly worked for a decade in the NBA. We've had him on the show before. This time is better. We get into a bunch of different stuff with him. We talk about his childhood in the Sudan. We talk about why he's confident to the point of delusion, even about things he doesn't always excel at. Karaoke.
Girl, I don't understand it. Why you wanna hurt me?
And also how that confidence helped make it at ESPN. We talked about how he's not an American citizen and how that affects his job and his life. Also, the infamous different strokes speech gets a run. And I think this actually might be his last interview ever because I had to edit out about 400 coughing fits. He was Greg Cody-esque in his inability to fight off the cough. So I guess RIP Amin, here are his final words.
That's what she said.
Happy to welcome in Amin El-Hassan to the podcast. Now, Amin and I chatted about 3 years ago. I didn't know him as well. And also, the podcast kind of got off the rails. If you want to go find it, you can. We're going to cover some of the same ground because there's stuff I'm still very interested in that we didn't do a good job of getting to. But it got weird. It got weird. And we're going to do a better job this time. I have faith in us. And there's still a lot I want to know about Amin. And so many of you that are listening to the pod were not regular listeners way back when I started. So this should be good for all of you that didn't hear that one. And good for those who did and are interested in a better job this time around. So, Amin, let's start at the beginning. You were born in the Sudan, and you moved to New York City when you were a baby and then went back to the Sudan from 8 to 14. So when you got to the Sudan at age 8, did you feel like you fit in there or did you feel like an American kid who got displaced?
Absolutely didn't fit in one bit. And with absolutely zero help from family, friends, and everybody else there, because in Sudan, it's like a really, I'm sure people mean well, but, you know, one of the things they would say, oh, you're not Sudanese, right? If you're, and it has nothing to do with where you were born or what your parents are, but just the idea that someone like me, two parents are both Sudanese, born in Sudan, but because I've lived any amount of time, it didn't matter that I left when I was a baby, it said I left it some amount of time, did not live in Sudan. You come back, oh, you're not Sudanese. And then they act very surprised if you eat Sudanese food. Like, whoa, I didn't know you ate that. And so it's, again, I think people mean well by it. But what ends up happening is when you're 8, 9, 10 years old, feeling incredibly ostracized and out of place as you're trying to learn a new language. I didn't really speak Arabic that well. I was trying to learn new kind of realities of life that just you can't prepare for if you don't live in Sudan. And so it was an isolating experience at first.
Did you have siblings that had similar experience, or was it you surrounded by all people that were full-on Sudanese?
Yeah, so my siblings, I have an older brother. He's 4 years older than me. I think he probably went through a lot of the same stuff. He spoke Arabic, I want to say, better than I did. So that helped. And then my sister, who's younger than me at the time, she was only 3 years old. So she was, I would say she was immune to that stuff at first. But she, you know, we've all heard it. And that's not unique to us, like I said. And it's not, you know, that just happens. If you just happen to be someone who, for whatever reason, you spent some time not living in Sudan, when you come back to Sudan, it's a very big, this guy is not Sudanese.
Right.
And it's supposed to be a cute little joke, but it gets old really quick, especially when everyone's making the same joke over and over again.
Well, and if you're a kid, it's super alienating as you're still figuring out who you are to have people constantly telling you what you aren't, but you didn't have a choice because you lived there. So when you were going back to New York at 14, were you really happy to get back?
No, because by 14, I'd already, I'd assimilated so much. And, you know, living in Sudan, you don't think that there's anything else after a while, you know? So, you know, at first it's hard, obviously. You go there, there's things like, you know, rolling blackouts is a regular. No running water, for whatever reason, is a regular thing. Ration. We used to have a ration card. You wanted sugar, there's only a certain amount of sugar you can have per week because they punch your ration card and you can only buy a certain, you know, amount. I was there when there was a military coup and the government was government upheaval and a theocratic militaristic totalitarian regime took over, and that's the same government that's in control right now. I was there. Curfews and secret police and, you know, lack of freedom of speech and, like, all these weird type of kind of things you read about in the news about these faraway lands. Like, I lived it, and after a while, you live there for 6 years, this is life.
Right. And did you feel
unsafe? Unsafe in a weird way, no. Like, there were things that you knew you don't want to talk like that or, you know, out in public because you don't know who's listening or whatever. But, you know, you hit a routine of day to day life where it's just like, all right, this is just it. And so when the opportunity came up to move back to America, I was like, oh, cool, because, you know, I had tapes and stuff that we had recorded before we left. So I must have watched, you know, people wonder why I love Star Wars because I had Star Wars on tape and I watched it a zillion times because there's no real entertaining television to speak of at the time. It's just state run TV. And that was really boring 99% of the time. And so like Raiders of the Lost Ark and Back to the Future and all the movies that I really love and identify with. A lot of it is because I've watched them all 100 million times. So going back, I was kind of like excited. Oh, cool. I'll get to see what's new and all those things. And then what I never anticipated was that I would have a culture shock coming back to America. And that hit me hard.
Yeah. Did you get into any sports at all in the Sudan, either playing or watching? Could you out there?
Yeah. So soccer is the most popular sport by far. And I played a lot of soccer. And then I started to get interested in basketball probably around 12 or 13. And then obviously moving to America, it made feeding that interest in basketball a lot easier and a lot more plentiful. And that's, I think that's when I moved. I think that's when it switched for me, where soccer used to be my favorite sport. And then basketball kind of overtook that when we moved back when I was 14.
So you get back to the States and you are living in New York again?
Yeah.
What caused both moves? Was it related to your parents' jobs?
Yeah. So my father's a diplomat. And so he was working basically in the equivalent of the Sudanese State Department. And so he was on assignment to New York when we lived in New York the first time around. And my youngest sister was born with congenital heart disease. So it was supposed to be, he says, now he says, oh, we're only supposed to stay three or four years and then move back and then move somewhere else because they send you all over. That ended up being 8 years pretty much because of the issues that my sister underwent with her obviously needing medical care, and that's the kind of stuff that was not and continues to not be available in a place like Sudan. And so we ended up staying longer than anticipated. And then when we moved back, that was at a point where we felt stable enough in her health that we could make this move. And we moved back, and again, I don't think the plan was forever for us to ever move again. We were just, and you know, I lived my life on, you know, I was starting to look at colleges in Sudan and trying to figure out what I wanted to do and all that. And my father ended up getting not like a temp job, but kind of, you know, like here at ESPN, we've got people with payroll and you have like contract people. He got like a contract job in the UN. And it was temporary, but it was something to kind of get the wheels going until he found something else. And eventually did find something else in UNESCO, which is one of the UN organizations that's centered around education, science, and culture. And so that was the kind of, all right, we got there. But, yeah, so we moved back because he got that job at the UN.
So you we're still a big sports fan. You get back to New York and you're watching and playing sports, but because you're good at math and science, you don't ever consider sports as a job you can do, and you decide to be an engineer. Before we get to the college where you're actually studying and pursuing that, when you're back in New York as a high schooler, did you fit in then as an American, or at that point now are you the weird Sudanese kid?
So, yeah, so it's odd because I spoke like I speak now. I didn't have an accent. You know, if you were not paying attention, you would meet me and say, yeah, he's from New York. You wouldn't even know until you ask a couple of questions of my name or where I'm from. And I said the answer, like, you're a foreigner. Oh, I didn't know. Right.
Right.
But the problem is when you present yourself or when you come across as local, it becomes very odd when you don't understand local customs or whatever. And what I mean by that is I used to get in fights over misunderstandings because I just didn't know. I think if I had an accent and how you say and like, you know, didn't speak English well, I actually would have had an easier time because people were, oh, no, he's not from here. And instead, and the opposite happened. You know, I got into a lot of problems because people didn't understand that I'm not trying to be a dick. I just don't understand what's going on here. And even like I remember like I got in a fight. We had like a retreat at some camp. I'd never been camping in my life. You have to live in a stay in a cabin and all this stuff. And I got in a fight because I was sleeping and I was cold. And so I used to get very cold. I still do. But especially when I first came from Sudan, very cold. I couldn't understand. Wait, the sun is shining, but I'm cold. How is this possible? And so I used to sleep with a hat on. Mm-hmm. And I guess like my hat fell off and one of the kids thought it'd be funny if they put like some powder in my hat. And then like I would put it on and have powder on me. But I'm a very light sleeper, so I heard the rustling, and I purposely didn't say anything. waited until everybody was gone, got up, showered, changed, went into the mess hall where we were having breakfast, put the hat on top of the kid who tried to do it. Powder goes all over his face. I got in trouble, and the principal said I was trying to do a hate crime because the kid who did it was black, and I was throwing white powder on him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I didn't even – I had no concept of what they were talking about. I think – I can't remember who was – what podcast I was listening to where someone was talking about they had to explain to Yao Ming what racism was because he had literally never encountered it. And I'm not going to say I'm at that level of obliviousness, but there were things like that that they would interpret about me. And I'm just like, I don't know. All I know is this guy tried to get me. And where I'm from, I never said, I forgot this. I said, where I'm from, if you do something, you better be prepared to have it done to you.
Mm.
And the principal said something like, well, that's not how we do things here in America. I'm not going to bend on that one. But there's like a zillion examples of things where I didn't. I'll give you a great example, an even better example, Sarah. When I'm talking about we first came back to America. We landed. It was probably around this time of year, maybe March or February or something. It was early in the year. And we're going through passport control. And the guy, the one passport guy on this side is talking to the other guy. And they're talking about, I guess they're talking about tax return. Get your tax return. And the other guy says, no, I guess Uncle Billy kept it for Christmas. And I started doing the math. I'm like, oh, here's Uncle Billy. They mean Bill Clinton. Like, they're talking about the president. Oh, the secret police are going to come and grab these people. I swear to God. Like, because I grew up, there were certain places you don't speak ill of the people in power.
Right.
And the airport was A1, like, they're going to come and drag you away. And so I remember that fear and looking around like, where are they going to come running from to grab this dude and you know, take him to what we used to call ghost houses, which is little neighborhood houses where they go torture people. I lived across the street from one. And so you hear people get tortured in the middle of the night. I wasn't used to sleeping in a room. In Sudan, you take your beds outside because it's so hot. And no one's got enough money to have an AC running all night long, you take your beds out into the courtyard and you sleep outside under the stars. Like, that's just how you did it. And so it was weird to me that I'm in a room. Like, not claustrophobic, but just kind of thrown off by feeling confined. And
right.
All these little things that if you just met me and like, hey, let's go to lunch, you want to play basketball? Sure. You would never know.
At high school that you did connect with or that, like, kind of got to know you and understood that you were a little different, but it was not something to fight you about?
Yeah. I mean, I had friends. I mean, like, friends in high school, many of them were, I would say, of a superficial level, and I don't mean that in a mean way. I just, you know, like, I didn't open up to people like that for the most part. And also, I rapidly learned how to hide the weird parts. Like the truly weird parts. But then, like, most of my really good friends were all Sudanese kids who kind of had similar backgrounds, who also lived in New York.
Did you meet them through family or school?
Yeah, no. They didn't go to school with me. These were just other, like-aged kids. And I call many of them family today, although I think if you did, like, the actual math, or like, sixth cousins, seventh removed or whatever. But I call them my cousins and these are my family. I call them my family because these are the people I grew up with and who get it and get all the kind of idiosyncrasies and all that.
So you get to college at Georgia Tech. You're studying engineering. By this point, had you been in the States long enough that you knew how to assimilate and people didn't think much of you other than your name not sounding American?
Yeah, no. I, like I said, by the end of high school, I'd figured it out. I think probably by the end of my junior year, I'd figured it out. As far as, you know, just kind of getting used to the environment and the things that are available. But yeah, so when I went to college, I was just a guy from New York. That's the New York guy, and he likes New York music, and he thinks everything from New York is better than everywhere else. That was that
standard.
Guy.
Standard New York. You know, a lot of people I've had on the pod who come from either immigrant or first generation parents have extremely high expectations for their kids. Your father being, someone with a respectable job. What did you feel like as a kid or even in high school and college was expected of you? Were there certain jobs or expectations?
Yeah, the joke is if you're Sudanese, you can be only one of three things, a doctor, a lawyer, a doctor, an engineer, or an architect. Like, those are, that's it. And then maybe lawyer, but like, because lawyer in Sudan isn't like lawyer here. Lawyer here, you think, you know, big time firm and like billable hours and stuff. Lawyer in Sudan is like legal aid. So yeah, it was always about something that no matter where you go, you're going to get hired, right? You can live anywhere in the world and you'll find a job. I have American friends who have hung out with us and with my cousins and stuff like that. And they'll meet other family members and this is so-and-so, this is so-and-so. And they'll ask something along the lines of, every Sudanese person I meet is either a doctor, an engineer, or an architect. Why is your country so bad then? Right? And like, if you don't have, we don't have visionaries or dreamers or basically people who can stake out a path that was not trodden a million times before it,
right,
by other people. And so my uncle's an engineer. My brother's an engineer. My cousins are engineers. My uncle's on both sides, by the way, father and mother's side, engineers. Like, that's just... Man, that's how we do, because that's what you go to school for. And so for me, it wasn't even like, you better be an engineer. It was just like, all right, well, I'm good at math. I'm good at science. I might as well do this thing that is going to guarantee me a job for life and make sure my family's taken care of and all that. And I didn't like architecture because I wasn't good at drawing. And I didn't like medicine because I'm not a big fan of blood and gross stuff and all that. And so engineering, there you go. And that was it. That was the whole thought process. And never the idea that this is something I'm going to enjoy doing. It was just like, oh, I'm going to have a job waiting for me when I graduate.
Would you say your college experience was pretty typical?
No. No, because a large part of it was, this is my first time living alone. And I was not prepared to live alone, like, from a maturity standpoint. I was out here wilding. But the other part, the part that I think is more important, was I got into contact. I went to Georgia Tech. And Georgia Tech is a heavily, heavily science-driven school, right? I know it might have changed now. Back then, you couldn't be an English major. You couldn't be, there's no such thing that, like, it was like, you're either engineering, math, science, or they had a college of business, which was econ and you know, econometrics and stuff like that, or they had a school of international affairs. And that was what we looked at, like, oh, that's what the athletes take, because they
right.
got to give them an easy thing. Because
right.
no one would be able to be an elite Division I athlete and also have this engineering course on, right? So I got there, and everyone in my dorm and everyone I met, they were all these real big, I mean, they're, you know, cool people, regular people, but they were truly interested in engineering, like taking apart their computer and putting it back together and like, they're like, oh, how does this clock radio work? Boom, 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 take it apart. And I realized that, oh, they love this. Oh, this is a dream come true to go to school here. To be an engineer. And I'm like, I'm just here because I got good grades. And I'm not trying to... I had no interest beyond the very immediate compensation that was going to happen after
right.
this.
So did you realize then during school that you wanted to switch focuses? Or did you finish with an engineering degree and then enter the real world saying, okay, I don't want to do this?
No, I it took me a while to figure out that I wanted to do something different, but I just didn't Well, it didn't take me long. I knew, like, this isn't for me. But then I was just like, well, work is not about being happy or loving what you do. It's about work. That's why it's called work. And so I was just like, just suck it up and get it done. Because I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know what other career I could have. Probably that's when I was in bed and my roommate walks in and wakes me up at like 6 a.m. on a Saturday and says, the Atlanta Hawks are hiring part-time job. And that's the moment where everything changed.
So you were into basketball enough during college while you were, you know, not taking apart your clock alarm to have someone reach out to you and know that that would be a fit or that would be something you're interested in.
Yeah, no. I was like, my basketball interest when I got to America was just, it went from like, oh, this is pretty cool, to full blown in there watching games and reading every day about it and like in the papers and all that. And then when the collective bargaining agreement changed, I was one of the first people to like get a copy of the collective bargaining agreement, tattered and stuff. And I'd read it and I knew stuff that people didn't know. Nowadays, we all know, oh, if you might get traded in the NBA, the salaries have to match. There was a time when nobody knew that.
Right.
Nobody knew that other than people working in the league. And so I was the guy that people call, hey, can the Knicks trade for sales? Like, no, because the salaries don't match. That I was that guy. Yeah, everyone knew, like, I was a huge hoops head and all that. But it wasn't formal in nature. In any way, it was very kind of like self-taught and rudimentary, I would say. But the cell that my boy wakes me up at 6:30 a.m. on a Saturday. You've been to college. What was Friday night like? Right. Like,
right.
So I tell him, you know, politely, get the f*** out of my room. And he's like, come on. And I said, they're not going to hire us. They don't care. Like, no, we'll give it a try. Who knows? I mean, there's going to be like 1,000 people there. And he says, well, we might be able to get to some games for free. And I remember laying there in bed with the sheets over my head and thinking, man, I just want to go back to bed. Well, free basketball sounds like fun. Going to a game for free, that'd be awesome.
Right.
And that was a sell. That's all right. I tried it.
We went out free there, stuff is a motivator of a lot of things in life. Gets a lot of people
moving. Yeah.
That's true.
So 500 people showed up, and we both got hired out of the 500 people.
Why do you think so? Because you didn't have any sort of, you know, like you said, it was cobbled together. It wasn't anything you could put on a resume. It was just in your head. What did you do to convince them?
It was literally the most entry-level job. They didn't give a shit that I knew anything about basketball. They just wanted to know that I was here to work hard, and I wasn't, you know, I understood that this wasn't a vacation or whatever. I'm like, yeah, whatever. And so it was field marketing. It was a glorified street team. We used to put together this sort of like carnival act of like, shoot these free throws and win tickets to a Hawks game. This is when the Hawks were.
I've done that. Right? It wasn't for sports, but I did that when I first moved to L.A., you know, flipping fake eggs on the street to promote Iron Chef and stuff like that.
Oh, exactly. It's that kind of stuff. You go to malls on the weekends and do this or whatever. And then so did that for a year. And then when we did that, we got promoted to the in-arena game operations staff. So if you go to a basketball game and in the quarter break, this guy's going to shoot for 7,000 point American Airlines miles to go to wherever, you know, like that stuff. We're the ones that organized and executed. Someone else actually came up with the ideas and the selling it to sponsors and all that. And our job was just to carry the stuff and tell the dancer to hold the card this way. And like, so we did that. And that's when I really started to get to know the basketball people and talking. And that's when I really started to think to myself, oh, there are people who do this for a living, not just on the side.
And your parents were cool with you spending 4 or 5 years working for an NBA team in a job that was not connected to your degree and didn't have a direct line to something "quote unquote" real.
No. My parents at first didn't know. They just didn't know.
What did they think you were doing?
They just like it was a different time. Like nowadays, it's easier for people to keep track of people at all times.
Right.
Right. Because
they just knew you weren't asking for money as much, or maybe you still were.
Yeah. Like I'm just like And they also knew my grades weren't great. That was the other thing they knew. I was like, what's going on? What are you up to? Da-da-da. I'm like, oh, nothing. And my grades weren't great because I was someone who coasted a lot earlier in life because stuff just comes easy. And I didn't know how to work at all. I had zero work ethic because I was the kid that, like, wake up the morning of and I'll just do it and turn it in and get 98. Like, that was my life up until that point. And then Georgia Tech is like, nah, like,
can't do that.
It's like playing for Pat Riley. Like, you can't just, like, I just rolled out of bed. And No. They're going to break you one way or another. And so part of it was a lack of work ethic. And part of it was, I recognize now, I just didn't care. It was such a, like, a pain in the ass. I was just like, whatever. You know, there's an old saying at Georgia Tech, D is for done. Like,
right.
Seriously.
And you were okay with it just getting done until you found something that you actually were interested in.
Exactly. And so when I told them I don't want to do engineering anymore, I want to work in sports, that was like, I could have told my parents that I wanted to, drop out of school and go join a commune or whatever. It was heartbreaking for them.
So these jobs with the Hawks were concurrent with your work? With your school, I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, so all those jobs were while you're still in school. When you ended up interning for the Knicks in 2004-2005, and then for the Suns after that, you had graduated by then?
So I'm working for the Hawks. I realize this is what I want to do. People work in sports. It's not just people who were former players or whose daddy owned the team or whose father was a big time coach, which was what I thought. I thought those jobs are reserved for this upper crust of society that I'm not a part of. And then I realized, no, there are all types of people who are working, who have different careers in this, who went to school. But I didn't know that sports management was a degree. I didn't know any of those things, right? So I decided, all right, I don't want to do this. I'm going to transfer out of Georgia Tech. Again, the wailing and the shock to my parents. And so I ended up transferring to Arizona State because they had a graduate degree program in sports business that was like number one in the nation at the time. So I thought, well, if I graduate from undergrad, maybe that'll give me a better chance to get into the graduate degree. And so I went to Arizona State, and it's like the exact opposite. I said going to Georgia Tech is like going to the Miami Heat or going to Pat Riley and being like drill sergeant. And then going back to like Arizona State is like when you're on the on-bat circle, you got the donuts on it, and it's like weighted, and then you take the donuts off, and all of a sudden you feel like Barry Bonds. And it was like, I was like, really? This is how you guys do college? And by the way, Arizona State's business school is really good. It was top 25 in the country. But I'm out over here like with a 3.9 GPA, like – Just like doing cartwheels and stuff. And a lot of it was because I'd learned how to work. And a lot of it was because now I'm driving towards a goal. Now, okay, this is what I want. And so I ended up finishing up my coursework early. And then that last year, I think I had two classes left. And so what I did was I did it. I had the internship. I got the internship with the Knicks. And then that was a 3-credit course. All I had to do was write a paper at the end of it. And then the other class, I think I took at St. John's and transferred it in.
So then you do that internship with the Knicks. Then you get a full-time internship with the Suns. And you rose up to video coordinator, then scouting coordinator, then assistant director of basketball ops working under GM Steve Kerr. Why did you leave the Suns in the spring of 2012? Did they let you go or did you want something different?
No, it was definitely a mutual thing. When I worked for Steve Kerr and David Griffin, who is the former Cavs GM that won the championship in Cleveland, that was the guy that hired me in Phoenix. I worked with them closely. Alvin Gentry is our head coach. We had a very small, close-knit basketball operations department that was hardworking, and everyone was pulling towards the same direction and just had a very positive outlook on life. And I thought I was going to work there forever. And I didn't, like, people ask me, oh, did you want to be a GM? I said, I never wanted to be a GM. I thought I was going to work for Steve and Griff forever. And one day they'd, like, make me director and just give me little raises. And I was cool with that as long as I got the input that I had and all that. And so what happened was in 2010, Steve and Griff both quit a day apart from one another over some clashing with the ownership in Phoenix. And so when they left, we got new management. And I like to say that that was my introduction to the quote-unquote real NBA. Because the real NBA isn't kumbaya and everyone loving each other and we're all pulling for the same thing. The real NBA is agendas and backstabbing and people dying to take credit for things. And that sort of thing. And I was introduced to this and I was very naive because I couldn't understand. Like, what do you mean? Like, people ask me, what's your end game? Like, my end game is to help us win a championship. Like, no, that's the shit that people just say. What's your end game? I'm like, my end game is to help us win a championship. Right. Am I missing something here? And so that was what I was introduced to. And then so very quickly it became like butting of heads of me basically realizing that I'm working for incompetence and not only incompetence, but paranoid incompetence. Like they did not want assistance or anything like that because they feared that it would give credit to the wrong people. So it was just bashing heads all day. And so at the end of 2 years, it was like of two extra, so this is my sixth year there. I was just like, look, this isn't working. And they're like, yeah, it's not working. And that's why we ended up splitting ways. And I thought I was just going to go work for another team. And I didn't know that ESPN was on the horizon.
Yeah, so you kind of happened your way into a job at ESPN. An editor asked you to write a sample piece, and they wanted to bring in someone that had worked in a front office, and you obviously had that experience. So then you get a freelance gig, and it eventually leads to full-time, which you've been at ESPN full-time since the end of 2013. When you started writing for ESPN, you were out of a job and you were in between and maybe a little bit soured on working in a front office because of your last experience. Did you think it was going to be very temporary and just something to do before you got another job? And is there any part of you that still thinks that you would eventually like to go back to working for a team?
No, I knew once the ESPN thing came up, I said, if this is something I can do, then I'm gonna do it. There was maybe like a... I want to say, it's hard now to remember the exact timeline of events. There was a couple of times when jobs opened up, and I was hoping that Griff would take one of those jobs, and so I would get back in. I remember talking to Steve Kerr shortly before he announced he was trying to get back into coaching when he asked me, did I like what I was doing at ESPN? And I said, yeah, I don't think I'd go back. And then you got the Warriors job, and they're like, ah, shit, I wish I hadn't said that. but he knew I had no interest in coaching. I don't like coaching. That's not my area of expertise. And so that really wasn't an opportunity. I don't think that would have presented itself anyway. But no, when I started working at ESPN, I was like, well, if the right thing comes along. But I also think that this could be really successful. And ESPN asked me, how do we know you're not just using this as a stepping stone? And I said, well, I just spent a summer, trying to navigate this NBA, front office churn. And it was miserable because I probably reached out to 20 teams and – want to say of the 20 teams I reached out to, six of them replied, some mixture of either, hey, we know you, we know you're awesome, we just don't have anything right now, or we got something, but it is so below your experience and your pay grade pretty much, we wouldn't insult you. So I think Washington had an assistant video job and Portland had an assistant, but they're like, you're not going to go back to the video room.
Right. So ESPN felt like a step up and also potential to discover an industry that you might actually want to stay in. I remember you telling a story on the Levitard show of being at one of those teams and getting up to give a speech, and it was the lyrics to Different Strokes. Can you tell that story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was a Christmas party in Phoenix, and we used to have, Jerry Colangelo used to have this tradition of going to a big Christmas party, and at the Christmas party they give out money to people for if you drove here in a car with a license plate that ends in an odd number, stand up, and then like they just literally do like random stuff like that. And so like you get $10,000. It was pretty cool. So the team was on the road. So and I think a lot of scouts are on the road as well. So like there were only like two basketball operations people there. And I want to say it was me and Griff, and they wanted like basketball ops to like say basically a thank you to the guy. Hey everyone, thanks for working hard, and we're all in this together, and da da da, like one of those things. And I grabbed the mic from Griff, and I say, I'd like to say a few words as well. And I said, as you guys know, we have a very diverse team. We have a player from Brazil and a player from France and a player from Canada. And, and that's the beauty of this organization. We have people from all different walks of life and stuff that we come together. They're pulling together for the same goal. And, a lot of you don't know, but I'm from Sudan. And I wanted to, in the spirit of pulling together and kind of all coming from different backgrounds, I want to read a poem to you guys. The poem is in Arabic, but I'm going to roughly translate it. And then I just started saying the lyrics to different strokes, and like 90% of the room, like they didn't get it. We were way over their heads. Everyone was like, oh, that's so beautiful. And then there was one guy who emailed me, and he was like, that was hysterical. And then for like the next few months, kept emailing me different clips from different strokes that were like his favorite. Remember when Dudley, like that guy tried to like molest Dudley or whatever in the mic shot?
Yeah, that was a big swing from them back then.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's hilarious. Immediately, if you started with "Now the world don't move," I'd be like, "What? Yeah. This isn't an Arabic poem." Well,
Griff knew because like the look on his face was priceless. It's just like, is this because like, by the way, at this point, it's not like I'm assistant director.
Right.
This is very early. This is really ballsy for a young guy.
Honestly, that feels like that's your brand. And I'm curious, to what do you attribute your confidence? Because it's it borderlines on cockiness a lot. You are confident even in things that you are perhaps not great at. Why do you think that is?
I think that so you ask David Griffin, for instance, hey, do you know Amin El-Hassan? Like, oh, Amin the Dream. That's what they call me. Amin the Dream. Dreamer for short, right? Because there's a part of me that lives in a delusion. You have to. Tara, I've never done anything media in my life. I've never written anything. I didn't go to journalism school. The only thing I remember was from high school, something about a pyramid and like the most important facts at the top and the who, what, when. That's all I knew. And when I started working here, I wrote for a year, never having written anything in my life. And then at the end of that year, they converted me to a payroll deal, a 3-year contract. And they said to me, by the end of the third year, you might be doing some TV. And 6 months later, I did my first SportsCenter. And everyone said, oh, wow, like, how great is that? Like, God, like, were you nervous? I'm like, no. Like, well, did you practice? Like, practice what? So if you're to tell me that I can walk into this industry, and I'm not saying I'm the best person at TV, but I'm clearly not sweating and forgetting my lines and like, oh, whatever. I did it having no experience doing it. The only way you get that is if you have this weird, irrational belief that like, oh, I'm going to figure it out one way or another. And sometimes you don't figure it out. And you say, it wasn't worth doing anyway. Like, and you just keep moving. And so, again, like I worked in the league on some of the best teams in the league with an opportunity to win a championship with Hall of Famers. I got into this industry, in sports. I wasn't a pro athlete. I wasn't a collegiate athlete. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any connections. My father isn't someone who can make a phone call or golfs with somebody or is a big-time newspaper writer in the town. I had nothing other than here's my resume. And also, this is what I think about this, that, and the other. Griff tells a funny story because we do a radio show together on Sirius XM, and I made a joke about the other host, the person driving the show, was like, all right, Griff, you got to give us a funny Amin story every hour. And so I said, oh, here it goes. I was like, Griff doesn't have stories about me, about what? They're like, oh, hey, go get me some coffee, intern, or whatever. And Griff says, actually, if I remember correctly, I was the one who got coffee for you. And I laugh because he's right. Because Griff was like, you want coffee? I'm like, I can get some. And he would go downstairs to the Starbucks and get it. So, and this is me as an intern, mind you. So there's, like, you might say that, like, oh, my God, it's so delusional. But it's like, it's gotten me pretty far in life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wonder if part of that stems from you're moving back and forth between places. And for a lot of people, that can result in incredible shyness or feeling like they don't belong. And I wonder for you if you put up sort of a hard exterior because you didn't fit in, and if that manifests itself in walking through the world in sort of like, if I puff out my chest and I'm confident about everything, people will buy it, even if I feel like I'm out of place.
Sarah, you know how to get to anywhere in an NBA arena without a credential?
Act like you belong.
Just walk, with, be dressed nice.
Yep. So I don't do it in NBA places. I do it in concerts where I want to get to better seats. Yep.
Just walk. Just walk with great purpose and don't hesitate and don't look around like you don't know where you are. And people will just buy it. And I learned that from my father, and he didn't even do it on purpose. My father, where we're going somewhere, he'll be walking. And he's got this strut about him. And then at some point, I turned to my mom and I said, I don't think this is the right way. I said, Dad, do you know where you're going? And he looks at me and says, absolutely not. He says, this is how he walks. He walks with such an air of like, oh, yeah, he clearly knows where he's going. He's got such determination in his stride.
And that works a lot of the time for a lot of things. But that can also be insufferable if it's not backed up by anything, right? And so there's got to be times in your life where you have been super chesty, boastful guy, and you don't have any shame if it doesn't work out, or if you're wrong, or if you fail, or if you're revealed to be, you know, lying about either what you know or where you belong?
Yeah, it's not. So I know a lot of people are probably listening to this, or probably fans of the show, of the Levitard show, are going to think I'm going to say something that I've said on air. No, never. Because I'd never, or very, very rarely, say something out of turn, especially if it's about basketball. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But that doesn't mean – my whole goal when I'm doing the job is, look, you may not agree with me, but you at least have to say, oh, I see the thought process of how you got there. Like, it may not – I don't think it's going to work out the way you think it is, but I see the logic. I see the work, basically. But if it's another sport, like not basketball, sure. Like, there's a time on Sports Nation. There's a story about Tony Romo getting an exemption to play in one of these PGA tournaments, right? And so I went up and I just ripped it. I said, this is a mockery, and there are people working their whole lives to, you know, try to make this. And there's some poor guy who got, you know, left out because they had to give a spot to Tony Romo. And this was his favorite because this guy wants to do it as a hobby or whatever. And I finished it, and Michelle says, no, the exemption is, like, on top of whoever already makes the tournament. And I look at her, and I look at the camera, and I'm like, who cares? It's golf. Nobody cares about this anymore. Like, yeah, I do that. A lot of that is me having fun with the idea that I don't know much about, like,
right. And we can't all know everything. It's easier to accept that than to, yeah. I'm just curious, were you at all concerned about finding a space for yourself in the media? Because most analysts are former players, or they're more serious beat reporter journalist types. Or did you just step in with the intention from the very beginning to be yourself and hope that that would work?
Well, I was a little concerned when I started because they asked me, all right, so what did you do? I said, well, I was responsible for a lot of the quantitative analysis and da-da-da. Oh, so you're the stat guy. So, well, not exactly, because I did work on the salary cap stuff. Oh, so you're the cap guy. Well, no, not exactly, because I was working on the court with, you know, like, oh, so you're a player development guy. Well, not exactly. I did a little bit of everything. And so I don't think they'd ever had that. They usually have, if you do something, they want to be like, former coach, former this, former that. And when you just say former, my title is assistant director of basketball operations. And people are like, that's really vague. What does that mean? That's the point. It was vague because I did everything. I did a little bit of everything. I went down to the D-League. And, you know, I organized training camp and summer league stuff. And so I had a lot of experience in a lot of different areas. But nothing specific that you could put me in one box. And so that was one thing I was worried about. Like, they're going to try and box me, and I don't want to be boxed. But as far as my personality, I knew, like, look, I couldn't hold it back even if I wanted to.
Do you know when to share info from GMs and front offices and teams that you work for and when you don't want to include that, even if it would be good for your job or be a scoop?
Yeah, I don't I try not to scoop. I think my job is not to break news. My job is to add color to news that is broken, right? So why would they do this? Well, because this, that, and the other. And it's usually I will reference a conversation that I had with someone who is not involved in that situation, right? Because there's a part of me, many of the people I know in the league are my friends. So I just think it's really awkward. Like, Sarah, if you're going through something, like, on Around the Horn, like, I don't know if you'd want me, like, to call you immediately. Yo, Sarah, what's going on with you and Around the Horn? Knowing that I'm going to turn around and say, well, I talked to Sarah. Or I talked to someone close to the situation. Like, that's not what you do to friends. And that's why I'm not a newsbreaker, because I know that's a professional thing. That's a professional relationship that these men and women who do it work hard at, but also with the knowledge that when they are interacting with a GM or a player or a coach, that they know, hey, this is a business transaction right here, dude.
Right.
That makes sense. Stuff that's going to make you look good, and you're going to give me information. Whereas for me, it's like, no, these are my friends, so I don't like to barter on that kind of relationship.
Tell me about your citizenship, because we talked about this a couple years ago, and I imagine it's even more challenging in recent years. For those who don't know, you have lived legally in the U.S. for a very long time, but you're not a citizen. How does that affect your job and your sort of everyday life still?
Well, it's tough because international travel it used to be very difficult because just getting the paperwork in order to be able to go to even somewhere like Canada can be tough. But now it's like there's a constant risk that the lawyers tell me that even if you got all your paperwork, you've got your U.S. visa, you've got your Canadian visa and everything, you can go. And then the guy at the border goes, no, we're not going to let you in. That's something that is more prevalent in the last 3 years, basically 2.5 years. The idea that there are people who are world-class scientists working at prestigious universities in this country, and then they'll fly like to a European summit or something like that, and then not be able to get back into the United States. Like, wait, but I'm the leading neuroscientist in the world.
Right.
Too bad. I don't like your name, buddy. Like, so that's probably the biggest impediment. Like, for me, I'm really worried if the Raptors go to the finals, will I not be able to go to the NBA finals? That's an actual concern I have. And then beyond that, just things like, you know, most people get a driver's license, it expires like 30 years or whatever. Or if you're in Arizona, it expires like when you turn 70. Me, my license expires like basically at the end of my contract. So 3 years on my license, So it's just like I go to DMV a lot. People are like, why are you always at the DMV? Because my license expired again. So it's
right.
Things like the day-to-day stuff that is very, very kind of irritating.
When you're without a job, which hasn't been for a while since well back when you were in between jobs at front offices and coming to ESPN, but in that time, are you at risk of being sent back to the Sudan?
So back when back in 2012, I was on this thing called temporary protected status. It's because Sudan is a country going through armed conflict. Congress passed this act that says, hey, we'll give these people temporary status to live here in the United States and work, but they don't have a lot of travel benefits, and it's not permanent. It's not like an asylum. It's just until things work out in your country. And so that had been going on for years and years and years. And honestly, that's what I was on, even without a work visa. I was just on that temporary protected status because it gave me the ability to work without having to deal with a work visa. And then, probably last 2 years ago, they canceled it and said, all right, time to go home. And that's when, like, I had to get with ESPN to get a work visa from them.
So that's pretty stressful for you. Are you
yeah.
having to now react to various like laws and policies that are changing by the day, or are you in a place right now where because of your employment, you feel totally secure in living here and in traveling?
No security in travel internationally, right? That's a big one, but no security in terms of, I know that if I get let go from this job, even if I get another job somewhere else, right? That's not a seamless transition. It's still a lot of work in order to get all that paperwork, and I don't know what I would do in between. I don't want to go back to Sudan because it's not safe. Right now, they're going through political unrest, and there's a lot of bad stuff happening in Sudan, and I don't want to be there. Particularly, I don't want to take my kids there. Not until I can be confident that I can get them in and out of a situation like that fairly easily. You know, they're U.S. citizens, so technically, if something went wrong, I could drop them off at the U.S. Embassy compound and then hope that someone will take care of them on the other side of that. But that's not a way to live for me. And so,
right.
It's stressful. And, you know, the most stressful thing, I think, is when you see some of these policies get enacted and people you know and who you thought there was a mutual respect say things like, oh, that's good. Yeah, this is great for the country. And I'm like, do you understand? You know, it would be like, it'd be like, Sarah, if someone passed a law, say, all Cornell grads got to get out of the country.
Right.
And, like, I know you. And I'm like, oh, thank God. I'm sick and tired.
Right.
Oh, hey, Sarah, what's going on? Like, right. You can't, it's one of those things where there's some people I think are a little tone deaf. They don't understand. You can't support a blanket statement and still be cool with the people who are affected by that blanket statement.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you able to travel at all, like, for fun? If you wanted to take a trip with your family somewhere outside the U.S., is that just not a possibility?
No.
Or it just takes a lot of work?
Leaving the United States takes a lot of work because I got, like, 99% of the countries in the world are like, you need a visa if you're from Sudan. It's not like an American passport. Like, I want to go to London
right.
for a week, and you just go to London for a week. No, it's like I got to apply, and the background check, and there's a lot hefty fees, and it's a lot of work. But even that, I would be okay with. The problem is, if I leave, even if all my paperwork is in order, there's always a significant chance that on my return, they're gonna be like, no. Why? No, I just don't feel like it, right? I actually had that happen to me. Where I left the country to get the visa stamped. And the guy at the window was just like, "Ooh, no, I can't stamp your visa. What are you talking about?" He said, well, because apparently there was someone who had been arrested for helping a guy try to join ISIS, and his name was, like, mildly similar to mine.
Mm.
Right. And so because of that, they were like, no, they rejected it. And so I got back in on my temporary protected status by luck. And this was pre 2016 when this happened.
Mm. Yeah. Which is, it's even harder now.
Yeah. So if that had happened today, there's no chance I would have got back in.
Well, and I would imagine when you're negotiating with ESPN, you got to hope that no one's a dick who knows your status and says, listen, we can totally lowball him because he really needs this job.
No comment.
We'll stay away from that one. Just a couple more quick ones. When did you meet Dan and when did you start doing the Levitard show?
I remember, so funny you should ask this because I listened to the first time I was ever on the show just the other day. And basically, this is when Hassan Whiteside was a big deal in Miami. And so they said, oh, you should get Amin on. I think it was Sedano who told Dan that to get me on. And so I went on, and I told some, like, Whiteside stories, and I talked about scouting in the NBA and all that. And I thought it was a regular hit, not unlike what I do on your show or other radio shows. But I guess to Dan, he was very refreshed by just how bluntly honest I was about things. And so... So then Mike Ryan, after a couple more hits like that over the phone, Mike Ryan said, you want to come in and do the show?
And that was the same with me, like, except mine were all terrible topics like domestic violence and sexual assault.
Yeah.
And they were like, wow, she's a blast. She should come around more often.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. So you know how it goes. Like the first time they ask you to do a whole show, and if you're like me, you're thinking like, oh, so you want me to go into a studio in Bristol and, we'll, you know, connect to that. Like, no, we want you to be in Miami. And I was like, okay. And then I flew down there, and that was the first time I met Dan, and that's where the joke is, the true story. It's not a joke. Where Dan thought I was a waiter at the Clevelander. Because I'm sitting there in that, you know, that little alcove right when you walk in where the printer is? I was sitting there eating a sandwich because I got there early. I thought it was like a regular radio show. We get there like an hour before and we got to do a rundown and stuff. I didn't realize, oh, no, they're not doing any of that around here. Like, so the guy shows up maybe like 15 minutes before the show starts, and then Dan shows up like 5 minutes, 10 minutes before the show starts. And he walked right past me. And then I hear him talking to Mike. He's like, well, is Amin here? And Mike said, yeah, he's right there. He's eating that sandwich. He's like, oh, I thought he was a waiter. Swear to God. I was like, damn, like, what kind of waiter? Yes, because that's what waiters do. They sit down and they eat your order.
Well, he was on a break. He was on a break, obviously. You were on a break from your job. You needed to get a snack. Dan's never done a job like that. Like, he knows. Come on. He doesn't know.
He has no idea what it goes into a waiter's job.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Whenever I always want to ask the rest of the Levitard and Friends crew, because when I go down there, I have my radio show at night. So I work basically from 10 a.m. till 9 p.m. I have 1 hour break at lunch and I go grab food and come right back. And so when you're there and you're talking about being hungover and like crawling into the studio, feeling it because Miami got you, I'm always like, man, I never get to get got because I have to work for like the entirety of the day. So like, give me a little bit of like your average trip down there. How much are you actually like going out and doing stuff? How much are you actually getting to enjoy Miami?
Yeah, I don't know how much I want to ruin of the show. a lot of this is, a lot of it is trumped up. It's like, you know what's funny? Will Kane, as a April Fool's thing, was he did the cold open for High Noon.
Yeah.
He says that he's going to fill in for Bomani. And then Bomani like pops up and says, no, 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 and he gets out of there. And it was a nice little
funny
April Fool's joke. And Deadspin and all these other, like, media critique outlets all thought it was real.
Well, Will's a good actor, dude. I had a fight with my husband last night about whether he knew or not. I was like, he absolutely knew. And my husband's like, no, he was really mad, genuinely mad.
Sarah, Bomani was lying on the ground right there.
Dude, I know. That's what I said. Don't argue with me.
I'm just saying, like, do people actually think that, like, Will K walks in like, finally I get to do High Noon because Bomani can't do it today. Hey, Bo, you taking a nap over there? Cool. Don't worry. I got it. Like, people think that. But, like, I do. You know as well as I do, Sarah. Like, we all play characters on that show, right? And because it's funny and it makes the show funnier and makes it more fun. But it's staggering to me how many people actually believe, like, all this is 100% true. Like, Sarah's over here suspending Sugata's sports center appearances. How does that even make sense?
You know what, though? I don't even know how the show works. And so I legitimately did call his boss and make sure that his boss, if Sugata's contacted him, would back me up and say that he was suspended and not able to appear again. Like, I actually went through the work of doing it because I was like, I don't know. I feel like they're just going to call and know that it was, like, fake. So I got to make sure I can, like, get this approved by the higher-ups.
It's funny to me how many times we do things and people just assume. Like, there was a time when we tried to clear some sound, and the sound was cleared, but Dan kept asking, like, they hadn't cleared it yet, and he was like, you know what, I don't care if I get suspended. We're going to play it now. Like, come on, man. We're not idiots. No one's trying to lose their job over,
all
like,
right, let's stop ruining everything, Amin. Amin, stop ruining everything.
All right, yeah, that's my fault.
If you don't stop ruining everything, I'm not going to edit out all the times you cough during this interview like Greg Cody. Holy shit, dude.
Oh,
are you
God,
okay?
Yeah. No, it's allergies, hay fever this season, so.
Okay, and I'm not buying that at all. I don't care if you're okay, but I'm worried about you. Tell me about Count the Dings quickly. This is a very new thing that happened, this sale.
Yeah, so a long time ago, we had a really successful podcast at ESPN that was NBA driven. It was called the Tulu Podcast. Slowly but surely, a lot of the voices that were a part of that left the company. And the main one was Jade Hoy, who was our producer. And so we decided to start an independent podcast company that would, you know, talk about basketball the way we want to talk about it, and then also include some of the more cultural podcasts that we had sprouted from it. And so I got permission from ESPN to be a part of this, as long as, A, I don't talk about sports, B, I don't talk about politics, and C, it's not for a competitor. So I couldn't podcast for Bleacher Report or whatever. So I went full speed ahead with that. I had my cultural podcast, which is called Black Opinions Matter, and we kept it at that, and we just removed all of the sports references from it. Basically what ended up happening was the podcast did very well. It grew tremendously over the span of about 18 months, and just recently was purchased by The Athletic. So they bought all the basketball podcasts. They didn't buy the cultural ones, but you know, that's, you know, to me, that's good, because if they bought, Blackfish then, I wouldn't be able to do it anymore because they're a competitor, obviously.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So that was a really big deal, and I'm really happy to have been a part of that and happy to, you know, start a company, operated in the black, and then sold it. I'm now the American dream, as they say. But most importantly, I'm happy for Jade Hoy because he's a really creative guy. He was the brains behind a lot of stuff that we did at ESPN that people enjoyed. And so to see him, he left. He quit his job to start this, and he really put his faith in his ability, and it worked out tremendously for him.
What would you want to do at ESPN that you're not doing now?
Around the horn. No, I'm joking. I never want to do around the horn. It looks so stressful. I see Mina, and I'm like, I'm too stressed just looking at Mina doing her prep work for it. So, no, you know what? Right now, I think I'm at a real sweet spot in that I really love the shows I work on. I love the people I work with. I think everyone kind of has the right idea. The only things that I would want to do, probably something in the digital space,
mm-hmm.
and something even, this makes sense, even more relaxed than all the stuff that we do already.
Right.
We pitched ideas in the past, and for whatever reason, doesn't get off the ground. But I just think that when it comes to ESPN Plus, we have a massive opportunity as a company to treat it like an R&D department.
Right, an incubator of sorts.
The last thing we should do is try to make the same shows and just make them for digital. That doesn't make sense. We should try new, outside-the-box, crazy ideas.
I'm in the midst of pitching something. I mean, so we'll take this offline. We'll see if you're interested.
Okay.
I think we'll leave it there. I hope you live to see tomorrow. You're coughing. This might be your last interview ever. So we appreciate it.
Well, I got to host a jump. That's the problem. So I'm going to sit there in Rachel's seat and try to be a professional. And there's no cough or mute button.
Yeah, you're
when
screwed.
You're on TV.
You're screwed. Thanks for the time, Amin. And you already did the Spanish Inquisition, so you get to avoid it this time. But next time you're on, we will redo the Spanish Inquisition and see if your answers have changed.
Okay, good deal.
That's what she said.
We'll be right back with more That's What She Said with Sarah Spain.
Everyone knows hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring's simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/said. Oh my God, I get to read my own ads instead of Stu Gatz's. I've really made it now. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employees who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, my listeners, not Stu Gatz's, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/said. That's ZipRecruiter.com/SAID. ZipRecruiter.com/said. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
That's what she said.
It's time once again for South Bitch Sessions, where I rant about something that bothers me and I fix it. And today, surprisingly enough, it's about another transportation issue. I have realized that most of my stress in life stems from getting to places or being at places with lots of people. Usually I'm in a hurry. In fact, most of the time when people meet me in some sort of public space afterwards, they'll tweet and be like, great to meet you. Sorry you were in a hurry. And I'm almost never actually in a hurry. That's just how I operate, is at constantly 110 miles an hour. And that's why this particular thing bothers me so much. It's when people don't scoot up in the left-hand lane to turn. You are allowed to put 2, maybe even 3 car lengths into the middle of an intersection so that when you get that little break in oncoming traffic, you can turn left and then allow the cars behind you to make the light. If you sit at the same exact spot as you started when the light turns green and you don't inch your way up several car lengths, thereby allowing others to get in the middle of the intersection, which allows them to essentially run the red light if the green arrow is gone or if the green is gone before they're able to turn, then you're a jackass and you're a jerk and I'm going to ram my car within inches of yours and constantly keep scooting right behind you until you see me in your rearview mirror and you're like, oh, why is that person scooting? Oh, because I'm a dumbass and I'm still sitting in the same place at this light and there's no way anyone behind me is going to make this light unless I move up. If you are that person, stop being that person. You don't have to be such a stickler that you don't help a couple cars behind you kind of run a red light if it's a green that's barely going to get any cars through, okay? One day if I snap, it's probably going to be about this. So please, think about other cars behind you. Scoot your way in. Obviously, don't block oncoming traffic from turning left, but if you do a little bit, that's their problem to figure out. It's all about you and the cars behind you. Think of it like you're a team. You are on a team with the cars behind you, and the more cars that get through that light, the more points you get. All right? Think about that next time. Okay. I feel good about what we accomplished today. You are a team with the cars behind you. You get more points if you help them. Get your ass into the intersection. There. I fixed it. Don't forget to check out Katie Nolan's podcast, Sports, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Katie will soon be back with stories from her trip to England, including a stop at Anfield to witness her beloved Liverpool climb back atop the Premier League table with a win over Tottenham. If you've got a dilemma for the commish to fix, tweet it to me at Sarah Spain on Twitter or go to the iTunes or podcast app. Subscribe to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Rate it 5 stars, 12 stars, 100 stars, and then leave a review and leave your dilemma in the review. And every once in a while, I'm going to pick a listener dilemma to fix. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's What She Said.